couple of short years ago, there was an event that basically went unnoticed. Oh, yes. A couple of preachers heard about it, learned about it. But the reality was, it happened in the United States, was never carried by the mainstream media, wasn't heralded from many pulpits. That event was the first time that Africa and India began sending missionaries to the United States. Now, before I begin, let me make sure you understand that my wife and I, we definitely support foreign mission work. In fact, some of our own personal finances go to foreign missionaries. I usually will try at least once a year to conduct something overseas, kind of a pro bono act, in order to take what I'm doing this weekend or this week and teach it in foreign countries. But friends, I want you to think for just a moment about where our nation is today. When we have countries sending missionaries to us. Many of you can remember about 20 years ago, the Russian mission work was a very, very big thing. Lots of congregations put a lot of money into Russia. More recently, it's been India. We're seeing lots and lots of baptisms in India. But I want you to think about what would have happened had we maybe spent a little bit more time on domestic mission. And by that I mean our homes. Because friends, while we were out saving Russia and India and places like that, you know what was happening to our homes? They were disintegrating. And so now they are sending missionaries to us. This afternoon I was talking with the ladies' Bible class and we were discussing just a little bit some of the morality issues that plague the United States of America. And the point was made on at least two different occasions how basically we've got a society that has grown up godless. United States of America, the majority of people, even though they may claim to believe in a God, they don't act like it. Now let's fast forward to the year 2010 in Rock Hill. And let's think for just a moment about your own children and grandchildren. Because friends, if you have children or grandchildren that have reached the tender age of 4 or 5 years, more than likely they have already been indoctrinated by evolution. And the reason that I can say that with such confidence is because not too many 4 or 5 year olds have not been enthralled with the dinosaurs. Now think with me for just a moment. What is normally a child's very first introduction to the godless theory of evolution? It's those dinosaurs. Somebody sitting out there says, wait a second, why in the world are we going to be talking of all things tonight in a church auditorium about dinosaurs? A couple of reasons, friends. Number one, because evolutionists are doing a better job of teaching our kids than we are. Number two, we have the truth on our side, and our kids need to see it. And think about what we do around holiday times. We fill our homes with all kinds of dinosaur figurines. In fact, if you are a parent and you have not stepped on a plastic dinosaur in the middle of the night, I'm not sure you're qualified as a parent. Kids love them, but it's not just children. Adults are also equally enthralled and amazed by these amazing creatures. Magazines love to put their picture on the cover because they know when they do so, they're almost guaranteed increased sales. They love to tell us where they were found or what they think they ate. Their size, for instance, the largest one that we've ever discovered is called the Argentinosaurus. They estimate this guy to weigh 110 tons. That's roughly 10 to 12 times larger than our largest elephant. If you want to see a replica of him, you got to go to the Fernbank Museum in Atlanta, Georgia, where he stretches literally from one end of the museum to the next. Just to give you a perspective, if you look right here on the screen, that's a full-grown T-Rex. This guy was huge. But friends, it's because of these same dinosaurs that we really are losing many of our kids. This is the sugar stick candy that they offer our children from a very, very young age. Let me show you what I mean by that. Christmas rolls around, and grandparents, we love grandchildren. So we buy them all kinds of things. We buy them toys, we buy them books, all kinds of stuff with dinosaurs on them. Have you ever stopped to look at what some of those books, some of those games say? You open it up and it starts out by saying, dinosaurs walked the earth 60 billion years ago, or 60 million years ago, long before man was ever on the scene. And so our children digest that. Now, maybe somebody in this room could also help me with another thing that grandparents do that my own mother has not yet explained. We have four children, and each year my mom goes out and she will buy them very, very nice clothes. So maybe somebody in this audience afterwards can tell me, why is it that grandparents often will shop at name brand stores when you had children that usually just got hand-me-downs? You can tell me that later on. So our children, we fill up our homes with toys, with books. They hit about 7 years old and we start taking them out of the house. We go somewhere like a Wendy's and we grab a kid's meal. A kid's meal that is teaching actively evolution. So our child is in the back seat. He's munching on these chicken nuggets all the while he is digesting evolution. Now I would point out one thing. If you look very carefully at this Wendy's bag, you'll notice in big red letters it has the word fact. Then underneath it says, new findings show the birds are probably related to dinosaurs. Reread that, folks. Fact. New findings show the birds are probably related to dinosaurs. But that's a fact. Our children hit 12. Okay, by 12 years of age, they have already been indoctrinated. And now they start taking field trips. And they go to places like the Smithsonian. Or maybe they go to the Fernbank Museum in Atlanta. Or maybe they go to Chicago to the Field Museum where Sue is on display. Now ask yourself this question. The parents of the children who you are looking at right now on the screen, do you honestly think they thought about what their kids would be reading before they signed that permission slip? Because friends, I took that picture. And I also took a picture of what they're reading, and I promise you there is no way that you can harmonize what they're reading with the Bible. Let me show you the problem. Last night I asked the young people over here, you guys remember I asked you, how many of you know about the Magic School Bus? In fact, let me see some hands. How many young people know about the Magic School Bus? Moms, dads, take a look around. It's one of the most popular of all kids series. You open it up. You got a little boy who has got a dinosaur. He is chasing a caveman. Notice what it says. This story is make-believe. Then it goes on to say, there were no dinosaurs in the time of cave people. In fact, the top left says, no people ever saw a dinosaur. When early humans appeared on the earth, dinosaurs had already been dead for millions of years. People found out about dinosaurs from fossils. Or maybe your child likes the Magic Treehouse. Another very, very popular kids series. In fact, I would point out, this is research guide number one. Now think about that for just a moment. Why would you use dinosaurs on the first of a series of books? Because friends, what better way to hook young people? You open it up, and in the very introduction of this book, it states, human beings, of course, had not yet evolved. And then you open that booklet, and you see a timeline that basically is dating dinosaurs back into the Jurassic, the Cretaceous period, and finally humans come into the picture at the very end. Now, just to make sure everybody in here understands the dilemma, the problem. Right now in the public school system, our kids are learning that dinosaurs died out roughly 65 million years ago, and that we came along carrying our clubs roughly 3 million years ago. Now, Wives, I realize some of your husbands may act like a Neanderthal, but that doesn't mean he is. The Bible, excuse me. I brought water. Bible paints a totally different picture. The Bible says not only that all land-dwelling creatures were created on day six, it also puts man as the pinnacle of God's creation on day six. Now, if that is true, and it is, then that would mean we had to have coexisted. Now, think about that for just a moment. On Saturday with the men, we talked a little bit about worldviews, and we talked about how your worldview is how you view everything. Think about how many young people have developed a secular worldview regarding these amazing creatures. Here's what I see as I travel all over the United States. Kids usually around age 13 or 14, they forget about dinosaurs. For some reason, they start getting interested in members of the opposite sex. I don't understand that yet. Thankfully, my children are not that old. 13, 14, 15, they basically don't worry about them, but they have already been indoctrinated with it. Somewhere around 18 or 19, your child begins to develop their own faith. Now, they've already been thoroughly immersed with this idea that dinosaurs walked the earth long before man ever did. They've also sat through science classes for many, many years that are teaching them words like proof, fact, and evidence. Science textbooks that are teaching them that these dinosaurs lived long, long time ago. And so when they finally begin to lay the foundation for their own beliefs, you know what normally happens? They place their allegiance with their textbooks instead of the Bible. Is this a problem? Folks, I mentioned on Saturday, it's taking four adults, four Christian adults, to get one child faithful into the next generation. In other words, we have a 75% loss rate right now in the church. You want to talk about a mission field? A true mission field is in the home. You think about how much bigger the church would be had we retained every single one of our children. Philip Kitcher wrote a book in which he claimed that solid evidence for the coexistence of dinosaurs and humans, notice what he says, would shake the foundations of the evolutionary theory. Because he says, of course, the dinosaurs are supposed to have been long extinct by the time hominids arrived on the scene. I want everybody in here to remember his quote, that solid evidence of humans coexisting with dinosaurs would shake the foundations of the evolutionary theory. Because we're going to look at some evidence tonight. Some stuff that you're not ever going to see in a science textbook or from CNN or Time Magazine. Because, folks, I promise you this. You give me your child for 2 to 3 hours and you let me do nothing but show them the evidence, and they will forever question the evolutionary theory. National Geographic GeoGuide page says, no human being has ever seen a live dinosaur. Friends, the question before us this evening is not whether or not they walked the earth. You know, in the church 30, 40, 50 years ago, basically our response to young people was, they didn't exist. They were a myth. Well, guess what, folks? We have found their fossilized remains on all seven continents, Arctic to Antarctic and everywhere in between. And it doesn't do us any good to look our children in the face and say, well, you know, they were just a myth. Because our children are eventually going to see one of those two-story tall T-Rex skeletons. And they're going to wonder, if mom and dad were wrong about that, what else are they wrong about? Now you've got some other people out there who are saying, well, maybe God simply just buried a bunch of bones for us to dig up later. Folks, I don't believe that our God is a God of confusion. I believe that, yes, these things actually did walk the earth, and we're going to look at some evidence that proves that. In fact, you think about it. We found them Arctic, Antarctic, all continents. I was coming off a plane in Oregon, got a call from a preacher friend of mine. He said, Brad, we need you to come to our church. I said, no problem. He said, I think I've got an opening in about 2011. He said, no, He said, we found dinosaur bones. Sure enough, I show up. They were digging an elevator shaft. They'd gone down about a story and a half into the ground. All kinds of dinosaur bones. We spent some time. We actually extracted several of them out, took pictures of them. I've got them on my computer. So if anybody ever tells you that there's not dinosaurs in the church, I got pictures of them. Friends, before we look at the evidence, I need to give you about a 2-minute history lesson. The word dinosaur itself came into existence in the year 1845. 1845, a fellow by the name of Sir Richard Owen, he coined the term dinosaur. He used two Greek words, dinos, sauros, translated by him as fearfully great lizard. You see, roughly 20 years earlier, the very first tooth of a dinosaur had been discovered by Gideon Mantell's wife. She was out walking around, saw this big tooth. In the 20-year span from her discovering that tooth to him coming up with the name, more and more of these fossils showed up. That caused Sir Richard Owen to realize there once was a whole tribe of these reptile-like creatures that used to roam the earth. 1845, I want you to remember that, because friends, the question, as I mentioned, is not did they walk the earth. The real question is when did they walk the earth? Let's look at some evidence together. For instance, January of 05, American researchers find a dinosaur in the belly of a mammal. And you say, yeah, so what? What's the big deal, Brad? Folks, remember, mammals were not supposed to be around. They weren't supposed to evolve until millions of years later. And yet you've got a mammal that was eating a dinosaur. Or maybe somebody could explain to me the Ica stones of Peru. A gentleman by the name of Dr. Javier Cabrera was given one of these stones as a birthday gift. He looked on it. He noticed it had these elegant carvings on it. He went to the farmer who gave him that stone. He said, where'd you get this? The farmer explained. He said, these are burial stones that the ancient Incas used to place in their tombs. In fact, if you look very carefully, you'll notice you've got an Ica stone here. I always tell this for the young people. That's a dead guy here. Dr. Cabrera was amazed. He wanted to find as many of these as he could. So he began to dig up these burial stones. All told, he found about 11,000 of them. And over a third of them show very elegant pictures of dinosaurs. And not just dinosaurs, friends. In some cases, they actually have men and dinosaurs. In fact, let me show you this one, see if you can kind of depict what this guy's doing right here. This guy has got a spear. He's hunting it. And somebody says, well, surely those are artifacts, or surely this is an internet hoax. Folks, you need to understand, the early Incan Indians got things right that we would not understand literally for decades later. Let me give you just one example of what I'm talking about. On the screen behind me, you see three Ica stones that have sauropod dinosaurs with these bumpy dermal frills on their back. Kind of look like the fins of a sailfish. Well, for the longest time, American researchers said, that's not right. We have never seen a sauropod with these dermal frills on it. That was until 1992, when that's precisely what we found. Now, folks, the point being, we had found these Ica stones long before 1992. The Incan Indians got it right the first time. It took us a long time to catch up to their knowledge. Ellen Morse Bishop, she said, the biggest spines found were about 9 inches long, shaped a little bit like a shark's dorsal fin. The smallest at the tail tip were about 3 inches high. Or maybe somebody could explain to me the dinosaur figurines from Acambaro, Mexico. Gentleman, he was riding on the back of a horse, and from that elevated position, he saw the first of these ceramic figurines. Now, again, all told, they found roughly 30,000 of these. They decided they would have these things dated. They sent it to two labs in the United States, Teledyne Laboratories and a place called the University of Pennsylvania Geology Department. Now think with me for a moment. Two independent labs, neither one of them know what this material is. All they did was they sent, for instance, a little piece of a tail or a little piece of a foot. They said, can you date it? They did. Came back with dates of roughly 2000 BC. They realized the implication. Folks, 2000 BC would imply that these people saw these creatures. They sent 8 additional samples to be what's called thermoluminescent tested. They really wanted to make sure they had this thing right. They came back with dates of roughly 2000 BC. It was at that point they called both laboratories, and unfortunately they made a mistake. They didn't allow the laboratories to certify their findings. They had already gotten the preliminaries. Called both labs. They said, hey, you know that material you're working on? It is coming from dinosaur figurines. At which point both labs did the same thing. They withdrew their results. Said, we're sorry, we're unable to give you any accurate readings on your material. But in 1990, we caught them, so to speak. 1990, we sent some dinosaur bone off to the University of Arizona. Didn't tell them it was dinosaur bone, simply did a blind study. It came back with a date of roughly 9,000 years before present. Now, granted, that's not 6,000, but that is a far cry from 65 million, folks. Or maybe somebody could explain to me this 800-year-old Buddhist temple that was uncovered just a couple of short years ago. Two of my preaching buddies have actually done some work over there. They took pictures for me. 800 years old, had been completely, if you look carefully, you'll notice there are vines all throughout this temple. They came in with what you and I would call industrial strength Roundup. Killed everything. Burned it in the center of this temple. When they did that, they realized that an artist had carved all kinds of things into these temples. For instance, if you look carefully, this guy right here at the top right, that's a monkey. Let me kind of orient you. There's his face, his front legs, back legs. His tail's actually curling up behind his head. This guy down here, some of you may have on your wall at home. That's a deer. You've got his antlers here, his face here, his tail's in the up position, back legs, front legs. But friends, this artist didn't just stop with monkeys and deers. He also carved things like dinosaurs. In fact, dinosaurs so accurately, can any of you guys tell me what kind that is? Stegosaurus. Now, folks, think about that for just a moment. How is it that today, in the year 2010, we can come back to an 800-year-old Buddhist temple and know what that guy carved? The funny thing is this. My preaching buddies that have been over there, they had an Oriental man who was giving them the tour, showing them all the different things of the temple. When they got here, they're snapping shots for me. They asked the man, they said, hey, how do you explain this? What is this? And the guy said, well, you know, we just really don't know. He smiled at him. He said, you know, some people have suggested it's a dinosaur, but he said, we've been told to tell people it's a porcupine. Doesn't look like any porcupine I've ever seen. Maybe somebody could explain to me this child's poncho dated 200 to 400 A.D. A friend of mine by the name of Dennis Swift, he made this discovery, was in the tomb of one of the Nazgan Indians. Its mother had laid this child in there wearing this particular garment. How did they know what to embroider if they'd never seen it? Or maybe somebody could explain to me the dinosaur petroglyphs in Natural Bridges National Monument. You know, if you were to go there today, just outside of Blanding, Utah, there are 3 natural sandstone bridges, one of which is called Kachina. And it's on that particular sandstone bridge that the Anasazi Indians, they carved all kinds of things. For instance, you can still go there today and you can see bighorn sheep. And you can also see dinosaurs. In fact, I want you to read with me what Fran Barnes, who is an evolutionist, what he said regarding this. Now keep in mind, this guy is a recognized authority on rock art in the American Southwest. Listen carefully. He said, there's a petroglyph in National Bridges National Monument that bears a striking resemblance to a dinosaur? Why didn't he just call it a dinosaur? Because solid evidence of humans coexisting with dinosaurs would do what? Shake the foundation, folks, of the evolutionary theory. While we're talking about this one, some of you probably remember, maybe when you were a little bit younger, you saw the pictures of those flying reptiles, pterodactyls or pteranodons. You know, allegedly, they died out with the dinosaurs 65 million years ago. That's what they tell us. And yet, I want you to remember the next two slides. In fact, if you are a parent, let me strongly encourage you to write down the references, because while these slides are not flashy, they don't have the best pictures, when you realize these are from historians that talk about seeing these flying reptiles, they pack a pretty powerful punch. The first one is from a Greek historian, Herodotus, 5th century BC. Look at what he has to say. "There's a place in Arabia to which I went on learning of some winged serpents," or hearing of some winged serpents. "When I arrived there, I saw bones and spines of serpents in such quantities as it would be impossible to describe." He said, "The form of the serpent is like that of a water snake, but he has wings without feathers and like as possible to the wings of a bat." So we've got a 5th century Greek historian who knows the difference between bats, birds, and flying reptiles. The other one some of you may have heard of, he's a historian, a Jewish historian by the name of Josephus. Josephus actually lived as a contemporary with some of the apostles, folks. This is a guy who chronicled the death of Jesus Christ at the hand of Pilate. Not only did he write about Jesus, not only did he write about the Jews, he also wrote about flying reptiles. He said, "When the ground was difficult to be passed over because of the multitude of serpents, which it produces in vast numbers, some of which ascend out of the ground unseen and also fly in the air, they do come upon men at unawares and do them a mischief." He said, "Moses made baskets like unto arks of sage and filled them with eaves or birds and carried them along with them. Which animal is the greatest enemy to the serpents imaginable? For they fly from them when they come near them, and as they fly, they're caught and devoured by them." All right, so let me get this straight. The same historian who chronicled the death of Jesus at the hands of Pilate is talking about flying reptiles? Folks, what does that do to the evolutionary theory, keeping in mind this guy wrote this long before Charles Darwin was ever even a thought? Or maybe somebody could explain to me this Nazcan textile dated 400 to 700 AD, identified as a dinosaur. Or maybe you could explain to me the tomb of Richard Bell. If you ever get over to England, let me encourage you to go through the Carlisle Cathedral. Have them roll up the carpet that is right at the very bottom of the screen. Because below that carpet, you're going to find the tomb of a man who died in 1496. You remember when I said the word dinosaur was coined? 1845. This guy died roughly, in round numbers, 350 years before the word even came into existence. When you have him roll up that carpet and you get down on your knees and you look at that marble elegant tomb, you're going to find animals like dogs, eels, foxes, and dinosaurs. 350 years before the word even came into existence. Or maybe somebody could explain to me this Mayan vase, dated roughly 100 AD. One of the neatest studies I ever did, I was going to a university setting. And I know this will surprise most of you. University settings are not quite as friendly as what I call the home crowd. Went there, I had completely redid the lesson that I'm doing for you tonight. I based everything on a map. And I kept jumping this plane around from continent to continent to continent, showing all the lines going from different places. It was one of the funnest things I've ever done, simply because by the time I was done showing them all this evidence, you could tell all over the world We had these folks that were making carvings or doing embroidery. The Mayans, the Incas, the Peruvians, North America, South America, Europe, all over the place. And you could tell, even though the people in the audience in that university, they didn't like it, they couldn't refute it. In fact, I had one of them come up to me afterwards. He said, you know, when you started your lesson, he said, I was ready for you. He said, I was gunning for you. You got about 3 slides in. I thought this is going to be a cakewalk. He said, after about 30, I realized I had my work cut out for me. He said, after you'd put up about 50 slides, he said, I really realistically just dropped my case. He said, I can't explain it, and I don't buy what you're selling yet, but he said, you definitely gave me something to think about. Because, folks, we've got evidence literally all over the place. Evidence that could have only come into existence if human beings really did see these creatures. For instance, we come to North America. Dr. Samuel Hubbard was the curator for the Oakland, California Museum of Natural History. He took a group. They set out on an expedition down in the Grand Canyon. They went off one of the side canyons called the Havasupai Canyon because Hubbard believed the American Indians had been here much longer than we were giving them credit. So he began to look for any kind of evidence that the Native Americans were here. He looked for things like their pottery, their clothing. And he was right. He found evidence. He found their pottery and their clothing, but he also stumbled across their cave art. Etched into those canyon walls, there were beautiful pictures that had taken men literally hours to carve out. You say, well, Brad, pictures of what? Well, let's see, there was buffalo, sheep, dinosaurs, oxen, and men. You say, wait, run that list by me one more time. Buffalo, sheep, oxen, men, and dinosaurs. In fact, I want you to read with me what Dr. Hubbard had to say regarding his find. He said, taken all in all, the proportions are good. The huge reptile is depicted in the attitude in which man would most likely see it. Reared on its hind legs, balancing with a long tail, either feeding or in a fighting position, possibly defending itself against a party of men. He goes on to say, the fact that some prehistoric man made a pictograph of a dinosaur on the walls of this canyon upsets completely all of our theories regarding the antiquity of man. The fact that the animal is upright and balanced on its tail would seem to indicate that the prehistoric artist must have seen it alive. Now, I brought with me a picture of what Dr. Hubbard found. And I hate to be the one to tell you, friends, but that right there is not a sheep. It's not an ox, but it's an awfully good representation of a creature we now know existed called the Edmontosaurus. So again, how did they know what to draw if they had never seen it? Or maybe somebody in here could explain to me the soft tissue that was found in a T-Rex bone recently. Actually communicated with the lady that made this discovery. Her name is Mary Schweitzer. She shared with me the fact that they had this T-Rex long bone, the femur. They had to break it, literally cut it in two, in order to get it onto a helicopter to take back to the lab. She says, when we did that, we were able to look inside where we found soft tissue, blood vessels, and what she thinks are blood cells. And folks, you ask any molecular biologist worth their salt at all, they're going to tell you, soft tissue, blood vessels, blood cells, they don't stick around for 65 million years. You know, we've got the evidence. The sad part is, our children will probably never, ever see it. Because this goes against the evolutionary theory. Somebody I was talking to in Chattanooga, Tennessee one time, said, isn't it funny how we get evidence in and it disproves, completely disproves evolution. You know what we do? We don't throw out the theory. We throw out the evidence. And folks, that's not education. That's indoctrination. And there is a difference between the two. Or maybe somebody could explain to me this pottery that was discovered in tombs, South America, these burial clothes from 700 AD that show dinosaur-like creatures. More pottery. Roman mural from the 2nd century AD showing two long-necked creatures. Keeping in mind, folks, that's hand-laid tiles that were put down just after our apostles walked this earth. Or maybe you could explain to me this Mesopotamian cylinder seal that looks an awful lot like what you and I would call an apatosaurus. Or maybe somebody could explain to me these tablets attributed to Narmer, the legendary first pharaoh of a united Egypt. You get the point? Friends, I promise you, we could sit here for at least another 15, 20 minutes, and we could look at slide after slide after slide after slide of proof that humans coexisted with the dinosaurs. But as I said, do not expect to see this in your child's science book. Don't expect to see it in CNN. Because after all, I don't think they're ready to give up the godless theory of evolution. And somebody says, well, Brad, do we have any other examples of animals that supposedly lived before man? Well, let's go all the way back to what evolutionists say is literally our beginning. On the screen, you see a picture of something we call a trilobite. Now, to our knowledge, these are extinct. You'll notice this particular textbook, it calls it an index fossil, meaning anywhere you find a trilobite, by definition, you are in the oldest layer of dirt on this earth. In fact, let me just kind of orient you for a moment. They say trilobites are here, fish come in here, dinosaurs finally coming in here, early mammals, we would be literally at the very top of the screen. Separated in time by roughly 500 to 600 million years. The only problem of that is in 1969, a gentleman by the name of William Meister was out, he and seven of his friends who were there to witness this event. They were looking for trilobite fossils. They scaled up a ledge in Antelope Springs, Utah. They tapped open a rock, and lo and behold, it split. He found two trilobites embedded in the sandal print of a human. Now, folks, think about that for just a moment. You just collapsed this entire column because you have human beings and trilobites together. In fact, I've seen it. I had them take it out of a lockbox in Texas because I'd been told you could see the sandal stitching on it. Folks, there's no getting around the fact that human beings were around at the same time as trilobites. Makes perfect sense to me. Because on the sixth day, God created all land-dwelling creatures. The guy who owns that, he told me, he said, Brad, I've been offered over $2 million by evolutionists who told him all they want to do is destroy it. Some of you may remember in your textbook seeing a creature like this, pictures like this. It's called a coelacanth. Supposedly, this is the creature that got us out of the water. Now, has it occurred to anybody else in this room that not only would we have to get out of the water, lose our scales, we'd have to get like tear ducts, we'd have to change our breathing method, do you realize we'd also have to convince our girlfriend or boyfriend to do it at the same time and evolve simultaneously with us? All the while you've got seagulls flying above these fish going, yeah, you better hurry up and evolve because I'm looking at lunch. And yet we're still teaching this garbage. I mean, you go to museums today, you open textbooks today, and this is allegedly one of the missing links. They dated it 325 to 410 million years old. Folks, the problem is this. We know today these creatures didn't live 325 to 410 million years ago. They're very much alive today. People off the coast of Madagascar and India, they have been catching these fish for decades. They call them junk fish. The funny thing is, American researchers found a fossil with these funny little front lobe fins, and they assumed that they were like little legs that carried them out on the beach. They assumed this was a shallow water fish that was the missing link. We know today it's a very deep water fish. It lives below the 18 degree isotherm. Somebody looks at that and says, okay, obviously, the evolutionary timetable is not as clear-cut as they would have us believe. But Brad, you still haven't answered one question, and that is, why aren't they mentioned in the Bible? I mean, if you're going to stand up there and tell us that God created dinosaurs and man on day six, why don't we read about them? But friends, that's not really a fair question. The reason I say it's not a fair question is because when was your Bible translated into English? King James, 1611. When did I say the word dinosaur was coined? 1845. Folks, how do you get a word in a book that is translated in 1611 when that word doesn't come along for almost another 250 years? A better question would be, is there compelling evidence of dinosaur-like creatures in this book? To that, I would say, turn with me tonight to the book of Job. You guys remember the account of Job? Job chapter 1. We are introduced to a man who is smitten with trials. His flocks are taken away. His children are taken away. Now, I don't know if any of us really can appreciate losing all of our kids, all of our wealth, basically the same day. If that wasn't bad enough, then his health is affected. And he's covered in boils from the crown of his head to the bottom of his feet. In fact, he is in so much agony. His wife, if you look in Job chapter 2, she tells him, she says, why don't you just curse God and die? And yet Job doesn't do that, does he? The reason we know is because not long after she made that very foolish statement, Job's three friends come on the scene. And I would put that in parentheses on purpose because they're not really what you and I would call friends. What they really are is nosy. They're busybodies. In fact, some of you may have friends like this. They assume Job sinned big time. And they want to know exactly what he did. So what you're going to read in your Bible for the next 25 plus chapters is a running dialogue between Job and these three men. Now, obviously, I'm paraphrasing, but it basically goes something like this. Eliphaz says, come on now, Job, tell us what you did. Job says, I didn't do anything. Bildad tags in and says, ah, come on now, Job. We can look at your life. We know you did something. He says, I didn't do anything. Zophar tags in. He takes his turn. He says, ah, now come on, Job. We're your friends. You can tell us anything. Till finally, in a fit of rage, Job burst out and he requests to speak to God. His friends had riled him up. If you look in Job chapter 13, verse 22, he says, then you speak, and I will answer you, or let me speak, and you respond to me. Basically saying, look, you can go first or I'll go first. It doesn't matter. Well, friends, in Job chapter 38, we have God's response to Job. The Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Now prepare yourself like a man. I will question you, and you will answer me. God's saying, you wanted to talk? All right, big boy, we're fixing to talk, only I'm going to be the one doing all the talking. And friends, if you look in the next three chapters, all you're going to read about, starting in Job chapter 38, are a series of questions that God is asking Job. These are humbling questions. He says, Job, where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Hey, Job, where's the dwelling place of light? Job, what about the eagle and the hawk? How do they fly? Job, what about snow and hail? How do I make those? Hey, Job, what about the behemoth? The behemoth. Job chapter 40, verse 15. Look now at the behemoth which I made along with you. He eats grass like an ox. See now his strength is in his hips. He moveth his tail like a cedar. What in the world is a behemoth? I would point out, by the way, this word is used not just in the book of Job. You're going to find it in the book of Psalms, other Old Testament references. Somebody looks at it and they say, well, Brad, I am so glad you're here because my Bible, it's got a little footnote. It says this creature is either an elephant or a hippopotamus. Well, let me gently remind you, your footnotes are not inspired, are they? But I'll go along with you for a moment. Let's look at the description of this creature. It says, lo, now his strength is in his loins. The force is in the navel of his belly. Obviously, this was a creature with a large stomach. All right. That guy have a big belly? Yeah. That guy have a big belly? Yeah. That guy have a big belly? Yep. Keep reading. Job chapter 40, verse 17. He moveth his tail like a cedar. The sinews of his stones are wrapped together. Now, friends, when it is talking about a cedar here, it's going to be talking about some of the largest of trees. You say, Brad, how do you know that? All we got to do is do a little word study on that word cedar. You remember it was the cedars of Lebanon that were used to build the temple, wasn't it? These are massive trees. He says he moves his tail like a cedar. So let me ask you the question. Does that look like a cedar to you? Not exactly. How about that? Not exactly. That's getting a whole lot closer, isn't it? In fact, if you have the King James Version in your hand, you may notice it says, this guy's chief in the ways of God. What is the largest land-dwelling creature we've ever discovered that's walked the earth? It's a dinosaur. The very next chapter, Job chapter 41, we learn about another creature. It says, can you draw out Leviathan with a hook? And somebody out there says, wait a second, Brad. Surely you're not going to teach us that these two creatures were real. Because after all, I've read where they are figurative or poetic language of the Bible. But folks, keep it in context. What is God actually doing here? He is questioning Job. He says, how did I make this? How did I do this? Why would he then turn to two imaginary creatures? Folks, not only does he talk about the creature, he talks about the environment they're in. Look at this. I'm going to read a couple of verses in chapter 41. It says, can you put a reed through his nose or pierce his jaw with a hook? Though the sword reaches him, it cannot avail, nor does a spear, dart, or javelin. Darts are regarded as straw, bronze as rotten wood. His undersides are like sharp pieces of pottery. On earth there is nothing like him which is made without fear. He beholds every high thing. Now again, some of your Bibles may have a little footnote that says this is an alligator or a crocodile. How many alligators or crocodiles do you know of that have beheld every high thing? To me, the true description starts in verse 18. Verse 18 says, his sneezings flash forth light. His eyes are like the eyelids of morning. Out of his mouth go burning lights. Sparks of fire shoot out. Smoke goes out of his nostrils as from a boiling pot and burning rushes. His breath kindles coals, and a flame of fire goes out of his mouth. Can you guys tell me what I just described? What's that? Dragon. Folks, think about that for just a moment. Ask yourself, do we have historical records of dragons on just about every ancient culture? Answer is yes. Let me bring you up to speed for just a moment. For instance, Marco Polo. I always have to tell the kids, this is not a game you play in the pool. This is an explorer. Lived in China 17 years, approximately AD 1271. He reported the Chinese emperor raised dragons to pull his chariots. In the year 1611, the emperor initiated the post of royal dragon feeder. Folks, we've got it in writing all the way back to 1611. We got it in our archaeological evidence. They found all kinds of carvings that you could only explain as being dragon-like. We got it in our literature. We got it in ancient artwork. And somebody says, Brad, surely you're not going to stand up here and tell us dragons were real, are you? Folks, there are two things that I know tonight with every cell in my body. Number one, I know this book is inspired by God, period. And number two, I know these creatures are mentioned in it. Somebody says, well, you still haven't explained the whole smoke and fire thing. Folks, ask yourself this question. All you got to have is a gas and a way to ignite it. Do we have animals that will produce large amounts of methane? Say like cows, for instance. Be happy to know that our government spent millions of tax dollars measuring how much methane cows will belch because they were worried about the greenhouse. So tomorrow morning, those of you who think you have a really rotten job, you be thankful you are not holding a burp meter to a cow. Now, you extrapolate from a cow up to a dinosaur. You think that guy could produce some methane? Do we have dinosaur fossils that have these elaborate horns that were hollow that we don't have a clue what they held in them? Like a Paracilophilus? Absolutely. All you got to have is a way to ignite it. Do we have animals that will take a mixture in their body, like a bombardier beetle, when they feel threatened, take the components within their own body, add enzymes to it, heat it up to a boiling temperature, shoot it out at their enemy? Yep. Do we have animals that will go down into the Amazon River picking up rocks and sand, striking it with their teeth to produce a spark? Yep. Is it possible? Folks, it's more than possible. I mean, when you really consider this earth and God's creation, the handiwork of God, there are lots of animals out there that really defy explanation. How do you get cold light from a lightning bug? We still don't know. I know this. I know scientists are doing everything they can to mimic that. Because think about it for just a moment. We lose a lot of our energy from heat, from lights. Met a lady who was in her 60s. She'd lived in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. She said, "Brad, when I was little, the scientists at Oak Ridge, they'd pay us a quarter for every lightning bug we brought them." She said, "We'd put them in like Ziploc baggies, keep them in the freezer, and then we'd go rake it in." You think about the electric eel. How do we explain that? A guy that can deliver 500 volts in the water, and he doesn't shock himself. I mean, that's kind of like taking your hair dryer and turning it on in the bathtub. Don't do that, please. He reproduces without shocking his mate, and he recharges without an extension cord. We don't have a clue how he did it. But we know all of these are the handiwork of God. Somebody says, "Well, that's good and all, Brad, but you got one little problem." Because Job, we believe, was a post-flood book. And by that, I mean, we think it's actually, the book of Job was one of the very first books of the Bible that was written. But we are pretty confident that the events of Job, what's actually taking place, happened after the flood. Now, you're going to stand up there and tell us God created man and dinosaurs on day 6. Yep. No other way around it. And then you're going to point out the behemoth, the leviathan in the book of Job. Wouldn't that mean, yep, they had to be on the ark, folks. Remember Sunday night, we spent a great deal of time looking at the ark. One of the comments that I didn't make to you then was, is it possible God allowed Noah to take juvenile animals on board the ark? Think about it. Take up less room. They wouldn't eat as much food, produce less waste. Because what was the purpose of the animals when they got off the boat? It's to replenish the earth. Folks, you would want animals that have a long reproductive life ahead of them. No offense to anybody in this room, but I seriously doubt there were any animals holding an AARP card. Don't think it happened. So is it possible God allowed Noah to take juveniles? Because think about it. You know what a dinosaur comes from, right? Is an egg. Largest egg we've ever discovered would fit very cleanly in both of my hands. So is that possible? Absolutely. As I see it, we've only got really one question left, and that is, what happened to him? This is the part of the lesson where I wish I could just stand up here and say, well, you know, the dinosaurs died out because, and give you a reason, and we all go home. But the true answer is we don't know for sure. And I don't have a problem looking you in the eye telling you we don't know for sure. There's a lot of things we don't know. In fact, I think it's kind of refreshing occasionally to hear somebody admit we don't know everything. We do have lots and lots of theories. Right now, in the field of science, there are 27 theories. The one your children are going to hear the most about is an asteroid that hit the Earth. To me, though, that asteroid really poses more questions of how it selectively killed off dinosaurs even on the other side of the planet. Number two, a nearby exploding star flooded the Earth with intense radiation. Number three, the Earth's climate became too warm, too cold, too dry, too wet for the dinosaurs' health. Number four, change in the dinosaurs' diet resulted in weakened eggshells that broke after being laid. Sad to say, number five really is a scientific theory. A laxative plant in the dinosaurs' diet disappeared, and they all died of constipation. I'll let you decide if that one was probable, possible, or pitiful. Do I think I know what happened to them? Absolutely. Friends, I think when God created this earth and he declared it very good, that it was a tropical-like environment that probably we can't even imagine today. You got a canopy overhead keeping a greenhouse-like environment, increased oxygen, which we know from the fossil record, lush vegetation. And I think the dinosaurs were thriving. And then I think God rained down his fury on sin. And I think those dinosaurs did walk on the boat. If you do the math, they were actually on the ark for 371 days. 371 days later, they walk off that ark, they look around, they realize we're not in Kansas anymore. Things have changed. You guys ever seen what it looks like when floodwaters finally retreat? You've got silt covering everything. Anything that was living has basically just been absolutely bowled over. I think those dinosaurs walked off that ark, and suddenly those little fuzzy, warm-blooded mammals began to thrive in this new environment. The flood put all of our weather patterns that we enjoy today into effect. Somebody asked me one time, they said, Brad, were there hurricanes before the flood? The answer is no. I can say it with confidence. Reason we know? Because the Sahara Desert hasn't always been a Sahara Desert. Antarctica hasn't always been frozen. You've got to have both of those elements in order to produce a hurricane. You've got to have cold air coming up from the south, hitting that superheated air from the Sahara Desert, and it rolls what we call cannonballs off into the Pacific, the Atlantic, and lo and behold, guess what? It wasn't that way prior to the flood. We talked on Sunday night about the fact that the flood kicked off the Ice Age. Lasted 350 to 500 years. So all of a sudden, you've got a physical barrier that these cold-blooded creatures cannot go too high or too low. And folks, I think they did make it. In fact, I think the evidence that I showed you tonight proves that they made it for several thousand years post-flood. But I don't think they ever thrived again. And eventually, I think one of two things got them. Number one, the change in climate after the flood. And number two, what has man always done to animals we fear? We kill them. Let me show you two last verses, and then the lesson is yours. Turn with me to Genesis chapter 1. Look at verse 29 and 30. God said, "See, I've given you every herb that yields seed, which is on the face of the earth. Every tree whose fruit yields seed, to you it shall be for food. Also to every beast of the earth, to every bird of the air, to everything that creeps on the earth in which there is life, I have given every green herb for food," and it was so. Prior to the flood, what were both man and animals? Vegetarian. Folks, it's right there in black and white, literally. Well, that explains a lot. That explains how dinosaurs and man could have coexisted because they're both vegetarian. They're not eating each other. It explains how all the animals could have gotten on the ark and been getting along together. They're all vegetarian. It explains how Noah could have gotten the food necessary. They're all vegetarian. Now, have the animals adapted since? Absolutely. Turn and look with me, though, at Genesis chapter 9. Right after the flood, God makes his promise to Noah. Genesis chapter 9, verse 3. "Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. I've given you all things, even as the green herbs." So after the flood, God says what? Fire up the barbecue. Now just imagine, we're 20 years post-flood. Noah sends out his boys. He says, "All right, Shem, Ham, Japheth, go get us some dinner." They walk out, they see a squirrel. They see a possum. And they see a stegosaurus. And they're thinking, that guy's small and greasy. Yeah, we'll leave that for the people who live in Arkansas to eat his roadkill. We could eat on that guy for weeks. Folks, please do not miss this one point, and that is for far, far too long, our children have been growing up at the feet of godless people who've been sharing to them their information about these creatures. It is time that we reclaim our families and we teach them the truth. You know, far too often we kind of get a little nervous, get a little scared. I promise you, the more you dig, the more you're going to realize every single aspect of real science points back to a creator. How about you tonight? You know, we talked on Sunday night about that flood. One of the things that I didn't mention, if you think back with me about 4 or 5 years ago to Katrina, remember the hurricane came ripping up through the Gulf area? The night that it came up through, do you remember it actually missed New Orleans? And the people were out in the street. They were literally partying, thinking the Big Easy had gotten off again. They went to bed that night, and then the levees broke. And all those little parishes began to fill up, quite literally, trapping them in their homes. You got people at 3, 4 in the morning screaming out, trying to get up on their roofs, trying to figure out how they can save themselves. All you hear in the night is the sound of human voices crying out. Electricity was gone. Emergency vehicles couldn't get around. And so all you heard throughout that time was the sound of human voices in terror. And yet I want you to fast forward, or rewind backwards to the global flood. Have you ever thought about what it would sound like when God literally extinguished the lives of every animal and human, barring 8 people and the 2 sets of animals? Folks, He's not going to put up with sin. I'll tell you what I see. I see people who go around, they live their life, and they basically think, I'm a good person. If I've heard that once, I've probably heard it a million times. And you may be sitting there tonight thinking, I'm a good person. I haven't killed, I haven't raped, I haven't stolen anything. And in your eyes, you are a good person. But let me ask you tonight, as you evaluate yourself and you think about God's attitude towards sin, are you good in the sight of God? Because, folks, sin will separate you from God. And the only way that you can get back, the bridge was built on Calvary. It's the blood of Jesus Christ. And the way we come in contact with that blood is to be buried with Him in baptism, to be immersed for the remission of our sins. If you're here tonight and you believe that He came here, that He died for us, you're ready to change your life, to confess His name, to be baptized, you can leave here a child of God. For the rest of us, again, as we continue our week together, I hope and I pray that some of the stuff that I'm presenting is challenging you. I hope that it's causing you to dig deeper, to fortify your faith. But I also hope it lights a fire in this community. And I hope it makes folks in this room determine that, you know what, in the past maybe we've been a little bit apathetic, but from this day forward, we're going to change things. We're going to change things starting in our home, starting at Charlotte Avenue, starting in Rock Hill, and we're going to spread out from there. Because the Bible tells us, if my people who are humbled by my name will pray, seek my face, then I will hear from heaven and I will heal their land. Folks, it's time that we humble ourselves, we pray, and we realize we need to make some changes. If you need to make some changes tonight, I hope that you'll come as together we stand and sing. Comments, questions, thoughts? Yes, sir.
I haven't,
but I will. I probably will in the next 24 hours, though, just to... What chapter and verse was that?
It's Isaiah chapter 30, verse 7. Okay. Thank you. Other comments, questions, thoughts? Yes, sir.
Foreign creatures came into America and they didn't report it. Why didn't they not report preachers? They primarily because nobody thought that was a big story. We send missionaries to all over the place. In fact, this congregation probably supports lots and lots of missionaries in different parts of the world, because America has always been a very wealthy nation, and God has blessed a lot of folks here to be able to do that. The big deal is now there's some of these third world countries that are starting to send missionaries here because they realize America needs help. Good question. Yes, sir.
Speaking at a university, how often do you speak at secular locations? What kind of reaction do you get?
How often do I speak at secular universities? I've probably been to 40 or 50 universities. Believe it or not, it's actually usually a pretty good environment. Obviously, there's always some rabid atheists who show up and try to poke fun, but I have fun with them because we do have the truth on our side. The one thing that I would say that I think is a kind of a travesty, been to probably 40 to 50 public state universities, I have never been invited to a Christian university. And I think part of that is because what I teach goes against what some of their science faculty are teaching. And so they don't want the headache and the stuff involved in that. I'll share with you my favorite university story. I was in South Dakota, was talking, doing a three-day seminar. The second night, we had three rabid professors that showed up along with about 150 of the students. They'd obviously heard I was on campus. So they heckled me a little bit during my lecture, but they let me finish. I got done, opened it up for questions. They immediately stood up. And they whipped out a sheet of paper where they had a bunch of questions. So I just kind of leaned back against the podium. I said, okay, let's go. So they started asking their questions. Well, after about the third or fourth one, it was obvious that they had not boned up as near as they should have. Because this is all I do. I mean, I'm fairly familiar with the current research. By the fifth question, the audience started laughing at them, which these professors did not like at all. By the eighth question, they literally took the sheet he was holding, crinkled it up, threw it on the floor, and they started attacking me personally. They said, you probably got your degree from a diploma mill, and blah, you know. And I said, time out, guys. I said, don't you think the students in this auditorium deserve to examine the evidence for themselves and determine what is the truth? And before one of them could shut his mouth, he blurted out and said, I'm not concerned with the truth. He went on to say, I'm just concerned that they're indoctrinated with our beliefs before they leave this institution. And I kid you not, folks, it was as silent as a tomb. I turned to the rest of the room. I said, that right there is why I'm here. They didn't show up the next night, by the way. Yes, ma'am. How do you explain the what?
Nephilim.
Sorry. Nephilim. Genesis chapter 6. Sorry. Genesis chapter 6. If everybody's got your Bible, go ahead and flip over there. It says, there were giants on the earth in those days, and also afterward when the sons of God came into the daughters of men. They bore children to them. Those were the mighty men who were men of old, men of renown. Lots and lots of questions and confusions about who these folks were. Some folks will just say that they were a race of people, that they were giants. I want to give you what I consider probably the two best scholarly approaches to it. There are a lot of people who hold that the sons of God were righteous people, that they had come through Seth's line, and that the daughters of men were Cain's offspring, and that they began to intermarry. And so that's why you've got a problem there, and these people basically were bad. I used to hold that a lot. I mean, that was kind of my view. I'm not sure I hold that anymore, because I've heard some folks who I consider to be exceptionally wise share with me and teach with me the fact that this word sons of God literally means angels. It is the same word as in Job chapter 38. It's pretty hard to get around. The thing that I'd always struggled with was Jesus tells us very plainly, angels are not given to marriage. So there's not a, you know, you don't have genders of angels. It's not males, females that are having offspring. So I couldn't figure out how do you get angels marrying the daughters of men until somebody reminded me that we did have a bunch of fallen angels, of which the devil was a part of, who, according to both Old Testament and New Testament history, have the ability to demonically possess people. I know some of you right now are kind of going, oh, wow, what did he just say? But think about that for just a moment, folks. That, to me, explains a whole lot, because you've got demons who were possessing folks, reproducing. Demons, we also know, would possess the animals, i.e. the pigs that Jesus cast the demons into the swine. That helps me understand why God had to clean house completely, why he had to clean up mankind and the animals. Because the more I've studied it, the more I've thought about it, and I know this is way more than you probably wanted to know. The text says that the evil of man's thoughts was on evil continually. I honestly believe the only way that we could be like that is if there was some kind of a demonic possession. I don't think man made in the image and likeness of God could be that wicked all the time unless there was something basically helping out.
So,
two different views, not sure which one is correct. Don't hold me to either one, but I am kind of leaning towards the second one.
Yes, sir. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Why can't we persuade them to reverse their
Great question.
He says,
you know, we've got DNA proof. We got soft tissue in a dinosaur. Why can't we persuade them to basically show this or to kind of get it out there? Multiple reasons, I think. Number one, who has the voice right now? I'll tell you who doesn't. It's the Christians. We've kind of, unfortunately, been the quiet majority for a long time. When I say majority, I'm obviously talking about Christians loosely defined, but you got people all over the United States who claim Christianity, but we're very apathetic, we don't do anything. That's problem number one. Problem number two is most of this stuff, we're having to dig, and I mean dig, to find, because they're not going to report the truth in common popular trend magazines. This is stuff that you've got to really dig.